Welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Richard Hoagland, and we are talking about his Chichen Itza arrest experience while, of course, trying to take measurements with the Accuton torsion measuring instrumentation. And it seems like the Mexican authorities, if you will, have some interest in this as well. And that's kind of where we left off, Richard. So just pick it up where we were and let's carry on the story. Very interesting.
Well, it wasn't until we got back on land, which was the 22nd, is when we docked back in Galveston, and then got home. And of course, that was right before Christmas, so there was a lot of stuff going on for the holidays and New Year's. It wasn't until somewhere in that, you know, next week-long period when I was talking with Ted in terms of what we had recorded, both of my experiences at Chichen Itza as well as my presentations on the ship. And we did some, you know, nightly sky stuff that we had filmed on board, looking at the sky from the top darkened decks of a cruise ship in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico is quite breathtaking because you can actually see the sky. And I wanted Tim to film some of that. Ted really is a good videographer, and he had brought night vision gear. And so as we're going through all the kind of debriefing, he said, by the way, did you notice those two guys who were up videoing you from Mexico during the last night on the ship? And I said, no. So then he proceeded to describe to me what they look like, and the fact that he had, you know, talking to some other members of our group, and they had seen them. And what I thought was so interesting is that they were prominently wearing their Federale caps. Now, why would you do that?
Yeah, exactly.
If you were trying to be surreptitious, if you were trying to, you know, just see what this guy had been up to, why would you advertise who you were?
Yeah.
It seemed to me that we may have a situation in Mexico very similar to a situation here and in other countries where you have more than one faction, you have more than one group, and there was a group that was trying to stop me from what I was trying to do. And there's another group who may be interested substantively in what we were trying to do. And the reason they wore their caps was to send a message, we're on your side.
Okay.
Well, remember, we're dealing with a world, which I've learned about, you know, through redundant experience, where nothing much is ever directly said. It's all in symbolism, it's in metaphor, it's in coded messages,
sure,
it's in between the lines. I mean, you obviously ran into this in interviewing all the people that you do for your show, that a huge amount of this kind of alternative edge, cutting edge research is fraught with all kinds of occultic references and strange secret society rituals and
sure.
things that don't normally fit into what we would think of as a mainstream 21st century business.
Yep.
It's got weirdness around it with a capital W. The fact that these guys would follow me back all the way to the United States and prominently be open to who they represented. I mean, there are people who say, oh, they were trying to intimidate you. Well, yeah, big intimidation, because they never came up and said anything to me directly. It was only because, you know, and I probably would have noticed if I hadn't been on stage and had to actually present. But, you know, I didn't personally see them. It was people that I know and trust who saw them and who report the fact that they were overtly making sure people knew who they represented. I find that very interesting because, and I'm going to fast forward the film really far forward now, a couple nights ago when I'm working way here making measurements, you know, baseline measurements, because we do Accutron baseline all the time to try to figure out what the physics is doing when you're not at a sacred site, I had an email from a friend of mine in San Diego who, you know, I got chatting with, and it turned out that he had been to Chichen Itza decades before, sometime in the early 1990s. And he went there because he had bought a copy of one of my early books, The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever. And there are some comparisons in that book to Mayan complexes and to the idea that what we have seen on Mars may have been immortalized and preserved in both architecture and in sacred texts here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he's back in the 1990s. He's got my book. He goes with a tourist group, which have a Mayan elder who's teaching them, according to his story the other night, an email to me, background on Chichen Itza. And he brings out a copy of my book and shows the Mayan elder the pyramid structures on Mars and says, is it equally important that the pyramid structures, and he points to the big pyramid that they're standing in front of, Kukulcan, be specifically placed on Earth according to this geometry so that they will work?
Right.
This is long before we've done any measurements, I've come out with any hyperdimensional physics models or ideas or projections. He's just basically taking our work on the monuments of Mars and talking to a Mayan elder at Chichen Itza one afternoon about a possible relationship. Well, he says in his email to me, it was as if he had struck this Mayan elder with a cattle prod. Hmm. The guy got all hot and bothered and rigid and wanted to know who he was and how he knew this ancient sacred Mayan stuff he wasn't supposed to know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And furthermore, he then said they've talked to some of their teenage guides, because apparently back in those days, which is, what, 20 years ago, they used teenagers to basically make a little money.
Right.
Guiding the tourists around.
A different place back then, of course, those sites, compared to what they are today.
Well, you would think so, but listen to what he described. He said that from his innocent conversations with the Mayan guide and the fact that they then spilled over to the teenage Mayan tourist minders, who then reported to their superiors, who were older people, who then reported him to guards carrying AK-47s.
Okay. Hmm.
And he said that they were coming toward us, and we got lost in the crowd and ran and hid on the buses so we could get away without being arrested. Hmm. All for asking the wrong questions.
Hmm.
So the gestalt of all this is there is secret knowledge of Mayan architecture surrounding these complexes, which there are certain people in the know about. And if you make the mistake of either asking the wrong question or bringing in something which is not expected, something out of place like a laptop to do actual measurements, they will be very unhappy and they will respond by limiting your freedom and trying to take away your ability to carry out any measurements. Isn't that fascinating?
And then,
well, of course, go ahead.
And then Richard, as you said, on the other end, you suspect that also you have another group of people who are who want to encourage you that your work continues, albeit somewhat laid back, if you will, not openly. Well, yeah. Well, if they show their support openly like that from filming you, that I guess they're on the level with you. They want to make sure you can do your work done, correct?
Well, one would suspect that's one model, one scenario. Of course, the other idea is that they are so arrogant that they were going to try to steal what we figured out. They couldn't do anything on the ship because it was not in Panama, no longer, Mexican territory. It was Bahamian territory because the Carnival Cruise Lines register their ships in the Bahamas. So technically now they're dealing with another nation. So they can't arrest me on ship. But they damn well could, quote, intimidate me never to come back again, and they B, could record what I was laying out as to what we found. See, there's without ground truth, without actually talking to them, without somebody telling you what's really going on, all you can do is speculate. I prefer to speculate in the direction that they were trying to figure out what it is we found because they don't know themselves, and they don't have this technology. They haven't figured out how to put it together to do their own measurements, so they wanted to see what it was that I had found until I got away from where they could no longer, tape me. At least that's one interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they wanted us to know that it was them doing it.
Okay.
That to me is the most interesting thing because I really think that there are groups, there are competing groups that are trying to figure out what this old ancient information really means, and there are other groups that are trying to suppress it and keep anybody from figuring it out. So you're basically caught in the middle of a war, and you know, a war that doesn't have bullets unless you go to the extreme, like my friend who said they were literally coming across the parade ground with AK-47s to talk to him when he, because he was, this was back in the 90s when it was a lot looser and you could, I mean, I've actually seen pictures. He sent me some pictures of what it looked like, and it looked nothing then like it does now.
Sure, yeah.
There were no tables, there were no vendors, it was just, you know, almost just the jungle, the site, tourists, and whoever wanted to come and commune with nature and this really sacred space. Oh, and the guys with the AK-47s.
Right. So Richard, let me ask you this then as well, as we carry on the story here, because we want to ask what you're measuring, how you measured it. We need to talk just a little bit about the Accutron, the yep. torsion measuring instrumentation, and if you believe also on top of that, that this is then something quote-unquote unique, that they haven't found out how to, you know, utilize what have you, so they want to see what your readings are.
Okay, well, let me describe briefly what it is we're measuring. What I've done is taken an off-the-shelf circa 1960s Accutron watch, which was an Accutron model put out by the Bulova Watch Company in the 1960s, which was touted back then as the first advance in timekeeping in 300 years. Well, what made the Accutron so different than all previous watches? Well, all previous wristwatches or clocks or whatever had escapements, and you wound them by hand. You had springs. You had, you know, pendulum bobs. And what they did is they either used gravity or the tension in a spring to drive the escapement, which in turn through gears would drive the hands on the watch or the clock and would wind up telling you the time. So you're basically converting stored potential energy of a wound-up spring into the long-delayed release of that energy in the unwinding of the escapement of the watch or clock and the moving of the hands so that you can wind up telling time according to an arbitrary standard, right?
Yep.
The Accutron replaced the wound-up spring with a little battery for electricity and a circuit, an electronic circuit driven by a transistorized system, which drove a tuning fork.
Tuning fork, that's right.
A little tiny, very tiny, it's like, you know, maybe a quarter of an inch long, tuning fork between two copper coils in the Accutron watch. And the transistorized circuit and the built-in circuitry of the wiring created a resonant electric ping communicated to the tuning fork through the coils that wound up causing it to vibrate rhythmically, resonantly, back and forth at 360 times per second,
mm-hmm.
or 360 hertz. And what the engineers had done at Bulova was to then take the pick-off electronic signals of this rhythmically vibrating tuning fork and used it as the basis of driving the gears that drove the hands that read out the time. So it became the basis, the time standard, of a whole new way of basically keeping time on a moving a mobile device, i.e. a wristwatch.
Yep.
And it was touted as the first advance in timekeeping in 300 years. Quickly surpassed, by the way, by a quartz crystal movement, which used the vibrations of a quartz crystal, which vibrate at millions of times per second, not hundreds of times per second, to produce ultimately a much more accurate watch and timekeeping standard. But in the interim, in the window there in the 60s, middle to late 60s, the Accutron was the cat's meow, as the old expression here in the United States goes, for the best cutting-edge, state-of-the-art wristwatches on the planet.
Yeah.
Well, what I've done is I've taken the Accutron tuning fork system, which is off the shelf. You can go on eBay and you can get an Accutron watch. And I've married it digitally through a program and some other electronic devices to a way in a laptop to actually keep a constant record of those tuning fork vibrations, and are able to monitor any forces in the environment that will change the vibration of that tuning fork. Because both of us claimed that their watch was so accurate that they could keep time plus or minus a second or so per day, which was, back in the 60s, an unheard-of accuracy for a wristwatch. What we've discovered is at the heart of the Accutron system, that little tuning fork does not keep perfect time. For reasons that are totally unexplained by any current mainstream scientific theory, including things like temperature variations or humidity or pressure, etc. That little tuning fork we have measured, particularly when you go to these ancient sacred sites, can vary radically, I mean radically, from 360 cycles per second. I have measured, in fact, I measured on the ship, on the Triumph, as we were leaving Progreso, going around the Yucatan Peninsula over to Cozumel. I recorded readings of over 1,000 cycles per second in sudden, impulses, and sometimes over the span of several minutes, plus or minus the 360. So something in the physics, in our environment, in the background field, in the space-time continuum in which we all exist, something is able, totally unprogrammed and unmodeled and unexplained by current science, is able to radically change the vibration of this little tuning fork. And by recording where and when and how, I am building up a database of actual scientific reproducible measurements that will lead us ultimately to the solution for what it is that's doing this bizarre intrusion into the normally very simple physics of what's called a harmonic oscillator, oscillating according to known laws of physics, which should be able to maintain a constant frequency of 360 cycles without any trouble. Instead, it varies all over the map. And in particular, the frequency of the Accutron tuning fork varies dramatically when you take it to a sacred site like Teotihuacan or Tikal or Chichen Itza, and you expose it in those conditions under the influence of those architectural structures built by the ancient Maya at particular times when the sun and moon and other celestial objects are in a certain configuration.
Now, is there anything, as far as you know, in the scientific world, if you can call it that, that comes close to being able to measure something like this? Can we compare it to something else that we know?
Nothing. There's nothing in theory that says it should be possible.
Okay.
In fact, everything in theory says it should be impossible. Because let me tell you what I think is really going on. This is where things get really, really, really cool. If you look at what's called the force equation, which is the way scientists would write the ability to change the frequency of a tuning fork, there aren't very many ways. You know, we remember from our high school physics that when you heat things up, they get they basically expand. When you cool them down, they contract. Well, the tuning fork frequency is based on only a couple of very fixed parameters. Its mass, meaning what it's made of, all right, that can't be changed, right?
Or as you know.
How would you change what it's made of in a little watch sitting on the middle of a pyramid in Central America? There's no way. The temperature, but of course we're looking at changes where you would have to basically vaporize it to have the effects on the tuning fork that we're seeing with the tuning fork sitting nice and cold, you know, with the way you brought it in. Or maybe the laws of physics themselves, something in space-time which changes that F equals MA part of the force equation. Something is going on at such a fundamental level that the tuning fork is behaving as if it's getting radically lighter or denser. In other words, its mass is changing, which again, under current theory, is impossible. How can you change the mass of anything unless you, bring two masses of plutonium together and you wind up, disappearing mass in the huge explosion of a nuclear detonation? There's no normal way at room temperature with something just sitting on a desk or sitting on a laptop or sitting on a pyramid to have the mass of the key vibrating active element so radically change that the frequency can change by a factor of 3 or 50 or 100. I mean, I've had readings where the low vibration of the accutron under the influence of a pyramid can go down to 10 or 12 cycles per second compared to 360. That's impossible according to all current physics. So the operative model that we have brought to explain what's going on is that the torsion field, the ether, which is where all of these physical constants derive from anyway, such as mass and volume and dimension and color and size and luminosity and all the basic ways you would describe a material object in three-dimensional space, something about the ether itself changes in the vicinity of these structures, these pyramids, and that in turn is changing the mass, i.e. the inertia of the tuning fork, and it vibrates faster or slower depending upon what waves in the ether are progressing across its physical location as I'm doing these measurements. I mean, this is stunning, cutting-edge, ancient lost science, which obviously the Maya have preserved in their very architecture.
What I'm trying to do is find something that might be in the vicinity, I guess, and I just wanted to pass this by you and see if you heard about it. There was a couple of reports of last year, I think it was, actually came out back in 2010, one of them here, talked about how solar activity is found to influence behavior of radioactive materials here on Earth. It was like the decay rate was diminishing, all kinds of strange effects.
I'm well aware of those experiments.
Yeah.
They're the same thing, Henry.
Okay.
They are changing the properties of the ether, which in turn is changing the properties of radioactive decay.
Right.
Now, can you imagine what Mexican prison I would be in if I had brought radioactive materials into Chichen Itza?
Right. That'd be good. Yeah.
Thanks. I thought we were friends.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So, but what you're saying is that this is, it's
in other words,
connected.
What the accutron is doing is measuring one what we call physical constant, which is inertia, which is amenable to change in the physics of waves in the torsion field, i.e. the ether. Where those same waves can change the rate at which radioactive elements decay. They will change the rate at which biology lives, thrives, propagates, the rate at which things, living creatures, live and die. We know that from some of the Mayan information that was given to me by our Mayan guide in Tikal when he saw me doing these measurements, and he said, "Oh my God," he says, I'm seeing on your screen what my great ancestors describe is going on, but we've never been able to figure out a way to see it. So it's all part of the same piece. In other words, the big lie of 20th century or 21st century physics is that there are such things as constants. Everything, according to these measurements, is in flux. And what the accutron is doing is measuring one tiny slice of reality, i.e. the mass of a vibrating object, and showing, demonstrating unequivocally that under the right conditions, particularly if you park it near what I call a big torsion amplifier, which is what these pyramids are. They're nothing but solid-state amplifiers.
So, and that's important, amplifiers, because they're amplifying something.
Exactly, because the average background torsion effect is 10 to the minus fifth. In other words, we live in a world with a variety of forces. We live in a world of gravity, of electromagnetism, of electrostatic fields, and the torsion field normally is like 1/100,000th as strong as these other forces in our normal experience. The fact that you can take instrumentation to a pyramid or an ancient site in Britain like Stonehenge and measure stunning amplifications of the effects on the inertia of the tuning fork means that the pyramid is amplifying in the ether the dramatic changes in constants that are undergoing, that are going on around us all the time, and we just don't notice because they're basically below the radar. They're basically below our normal, what we call signal-to-noise ability to measure. And that is stunning science. We are rediscovering in ancient science. We're actually rediscovering in public what the black world, the world of you know, secret military R&D and black ops programs has known for decades, mm-hmm. and is put to use to develop all kinds of amazing technologies like man-made UFOs, flying saucers, anti-gravity spacecraft, top-secret aircraft that are tested where no one ever sees what their capabilities are. And I'm looking at the transfer between the white world and the black world, and obviously there are folks who guard these pyramids, these ancient structures, who know that they are the key to breaking this out of the black world and moving it into the light, and they don't want it to happen. At the same time, there appear to be another group affiliated in the same power structure, because they wore the Federale's caps, who are basically telling us by simply wearing their symbology, hey, we know what you're doing, we're on your side, and we're trying to figure out how it works like you are.
And Richard, do you think that the structures are amplifying something that is tied to the location where they are placed, or could this be done anywhere by building such a structure?
No. I think it has to do with the sacred network, because the network is geometric. There are people, Began, and I forget who the other author was years ago, and some Russian investigators who looked at what's called the sacred global grid.
Yeah.
You have to build these structures. My departed friend David Flynn was very much into this kind of reconstruction of these ancient sacred sites according to a geometry all over the planet. I think, bottom line, is that the reason that these sacred sites were built from culture to culture to culture is that when push comes to shove at these critical times in the calendar, like the end of the Mayan Bakhtun, the 13th Bakhtun, the physics gets so shaky that the actual continued methodical rotation of the Earth and the alignment of the Earth in the solar system with its tilt to the sun of 23.5 degrees could potentially be changed, and that the pyramid network or the sacred site network all over the planet, which has been bequeathed to us over the last several thousand years as each of these indigenous cultures has built according to the same geometry and mathematics, and from my measurements now, according to the same physics, a set of monuments in this global network whose purpose is to basically stabilize the entire planet as a global grid resonating with each other in the torsion field, which stabilizes the planetary spin and axial inclination so that it continues to do exactly what it's doing day after day, week after week, year after year.
And without it,
bad things conceivably could happen. Because remember, we're measuring in the physics periods not only of resonance, but of dissonance. You know, if the field can change the vibration rate of a little tuning fork just sitting near a pyramid. What could similar perturbations in the force do to the steady rotation or tilt of the entire planet? Remember, the heart of this physics, hyperdimensional torsion field physics, is rotation, rotation, rotation. If you have a non-moving solid-state detector in the vicinity of these structures, they won't see anything. Your detector has to be moving. There's a whole series of experiments done by a brilliant Russian astrophysicist named Nikolai Kozarev back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. He's no longer with us now, but he's left a tremendous legacy in the form of his publications. And he demonstrates unequivocally in his experiments, his lab experiments, with the same field, that the detector has to be moving. It must either be rotating or vibrating, and in the Accutron, that little vibration of the tuning fork is actually a constrained rotation. Think of a tuning fork as a pendulum upside down, and its forced vibration, its resonant vibration, as part of an arc of a pendulum swing, and you'll see the relationship between these two systems of measurement. And what Kozarev found, and other investigators in other parts of the planet in later years have reconfirmed over and over again, people like De Palma, people like Maurice Allais, who was a brilliant Nobel laureate in France, who was conducting similar experiments, only he was using pendulums as opposed to tuning forks. All of us guys are measuring the same phenomenon with the same attributes, the same abilities to, when you're dealing with moving masses, to alter the inertia, i.e. the mass of something in motion under the influence of the right kind of resonant torsion field. And we can record and document and reproduce at will these results, and that's why it's real science, and it's mind-blowing science because its implications are totally off scale. One of the experiments that I wanted to do at Chichen Itza, which we had never been able to do at any of the other places where we measured, is to measure the effect of human consciousness on the Accutron tuning fork.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we could do that is because in our intention, as opposed to going in just, you know, me and Robin, we were going to go in with a whole group of people, and I was going to measure the pyramid in the ideal before they started meditating. Then during their meditation, and then after their meditation closed. And my idea here was to see if in the vicinity of this enormous amplifier, which could amplify subtle changes in the background field, I could actually, using the time reference, beginning, middle, and end, I could chart and see whether the influence of a group of likewise thinking humans could materially change the field to where the Accutron vibration rate would materially change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, guess what?
What?
We did, and it does.
Okay.
While we were there, remember, we had two groups. We had the 100 with Han Butzmann, and then I had my 50. My 50, you know, sent off to do their diversionary thing. Well, the Han Butzmann group, not knowing any of what was going on, they came in on their timetable, and they set up, and they actually started meditating. And I was unable to get my system going before they started, because they actually, because of the lack of being able to, or having to sneak in, they actually got there earlier than we did. So they had started, about 15 minutes before we actually got situated. But I was able to record the response of the pyramid. And this is all very important, because I told my people, in addition to creating diversions, I want you all to keep notes, either on your cell phone or on a notebook or your iPad or your iPhone. With time hacks, I want at 11:15, felt so-and-so. 11:25, observed so-and-so. You know, a quarter of 12, saw so-and-so, felt so-and-so. And a lot of them did. So I have like a network of timed responses of their individual meditative experiences and their internal shifts in consciousness noted down, as well as their noting what was going on in the vicinity of the pyramid during this entire time frame.
And Richard, it has to be tremendously difficult to know what affects what here, what begins to instigate a change, if you will, and how the effect of that kind of
I had expected it would be very difficult, but it turns out not to be. Because very clearly, when we got back to the ship, I had one of my away team people, his name is Orrin Miller, he and his significant other, Joan, kept meticulous notes. He sat at the base of the pyramid by one of those stairs and meditated for almost the entire hour, just noting and observing and writing things down. And she wandered around and took notes and did meditations in other places in the complex. And from their two reports alone, I can match moment to moment the progression of the measurements of the Accutron. That when Hombudsman's group was meditating, the frequencies were high. As soon as they stopped meditating, the frequency fell. When the guards, this is a part of the story I didn't get to before, the guards, the Federales, came up to Hombudsman's group and told him he couldn't lead a meditation.
Okay.
At the same time? Well, when that happened, which was 12:17 local time on Chichen Itza on the December 19th, on that day, I can see a stunning fall of the readings to the lowest of any we recorded in the complex exactly when the group was told they were, quote, being arrested. It's right there on the graph. And I would not have seen it if we had not been in the field of the Chichen Itza complex. In other words, you need that background amplification to see moment to moment the sensitivity changes of collective consciousness of just a few people. It was stunning. Now, obviously, we got to do this again. We have to reproduce it, hopefully in ways where we will not get caught and where they will not be able to stop it.
Right. Well, because I wanted to ask you this. In your data collection then so far, is there anything that indicates that there was something special to this day, this time? Was it within a few minutes, or was it under a whole week, more or less? What do you think?
Well, in order to know whether this day was important and unique, you'd have to be there for a period of time. The fact that they threw me out after only a few minutes made that a tad difficult.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But based on measurements at other complexes and based on what some of our away team members were able to measure surreptitiously by going back for the 21st, and if we have time, I'll get into that, I can be pretty confident in saying that it was the time, the solstice, and the end of the Bakhtun that created a measurable change in the physics that would not be what you'd normally measure on any other given day. Now, whether those changes would have been swamped by, let's say, an alignment between Venus and the Moon and the Sun, which we recorded at Tikal, where I got stunning readings in 2009, which is, 2 years before the end of the 13th Bakhtun, I cannot at this point say because we haven't got the synoptic measurements.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel, and this is something I really want to lay out there, I do feel that one of the reasons why the Chichen Itzan authorities did not want me to measure at Chichen Itza was because I was able to confirm with these measurements that, in fact, the whole hype around the end of the Mayan calendar and 2012, December 21, 2012, was wrong.
Okay.
Not in terms of anticipation of something happening.
Mm-hmm.
But wrong in terms of the date when that something could happen. I now believe, based on these measurements, and I've got some other things to do to make this kind of rock solid, that the actual end date of the 13th Bakhtun, according to the current Gregorian calendar, was not last year at the end of 2012. It's in fact going to be December 21, 2016. And I can demonstrate that in the measurements put together with our measurements of Venus and our measurements of the solar eclipse we recorded in 2012 as a coherent model, as a paper that I'm currently working on. I think I can make a very compelling case that, in fact, the best, the most interesting, the most exciting changes in the physics and concomitant changes in the consciousness of people all over the planet via this interconnected sacred site network, which vibrates in resonance in unison to these key events, again, which I've been able to measure, that the exciting climax of all of that is coming in 2016, and that 2012 was merely a foreshadowing because of an error in matching the Gregorian calendar to the Mayan calendar, which has been done by scholars either inadvertently or by design. I have to mention that. These guys cannot be so damn dumb that not one of them figured out how to do this correctly. And I'm going to lay out in this paper why I think the real date of 2012 is yet to come, and measurably there should be some very significant changes in the field with all kinds of side effects in our so-called real world.
Uh-oh, a new 2012, and it's 2016.
Well, but did I say anything bad?
No.
I say catastrophe was going to happen?
No, I said sure changes.
If the entire purpose of this global network is two things. One, to stabilize physically the planet so life goes on, and two, to change consciousness so that life goes on better. I've got measurements that document both of those models in the affirmative.
Is there any other tidbits, if you will, that you can give us why you come to this conclusion?
Well, the thing that's really absolutely hit me between the eyes has been the soap opera going on over the last few days with the ship, the cruise ship, the 100,000 ton.
I had a bookmark about that. We wanted to return there.
Yeah, because, I mean, look, have you ever seen an American film called Casablanca?
You know what? I think I've never actually seen the whole movie. It's been on 1,000 times in the background in different ways, but I don't think actually I've sat down and actually looked at it.
Okay.
So, sorry about that.
You know, the most famous cliche from the movie is when Humphrey Bogart says to the piano player, of all the gin joints in all the world that I should come in here, that kind of thing, because he meets his long-lost love in this one gin joint in Morocco in the film, which is the cornerstone of the love story of the film. And the idea is the total improbability of him being at the right place at the right time to meet her again in that particular place, right?
Yeah.
Okay, think about this. I take the only boat, I'm using a derogatory term now, the only boat that's going to Chichen Itza is the Carnival Triumph of all the cruises in all the world. The only ship that leaves from the United States and goes to Chichen Itza was going there because it already makes the run every week, to and from, like clockwork. It leaves Galveston, takes, 2 days to get to Progreso, you get on the buses, you go to Chichen Itza, you get back on the buses, you go back to the ship, you go around from Progreso to Cozumel, you stay there one day, and then you head back across the Gulf, and you arrive 5 days later in Galveston, and that's your cruise.
Mm-hmm.
On the Carnival Triumph cruise ship, a 100,000-ton liner that was built and commissioned back in, I think, 1999. In July of 1999 is when she had her first cruise. Okay, we're on the Triumph, and I do all these measurements. A few days later, all hell breaks loose, and the Triumph is stranded in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, and 4,000 passengers and crew live through living hell and just get back to land last night when we're recording this after having experienced that, thank God, didn't occur on our cruise. Otherwise, it would have totally messed up taking these measurements, right?
Yep.
So then you have to ask the question, how come the same weird thing happened to that ship that we were on just days before? Of all the cruise ships, of all the commercial passenger ships, of all the cargo container ships that actually also carry passengers all over the world, and I actually looked up last night on Google how many there are, there's 100,000 large ships of 20, 30, 50, 100,000 tons carrying passengers all over the planet, even as I speak right now.
Mm-hmm.
100,000. What are the odds that that ship that we were on would be the one to suffer major damage and be crippled on the way back to the States? And I was thinking, is there something unique about that ship? And lo and behold, looking at my data on the Accutron, and I'm going to publish this on Enterprise in the next 2 or 3 days, so by the time this is on air, everybody can go to Enterprise and they can look on Enterprise and they'll see this paper with stunning data.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the Triumph was exposed, according to my measurements, to an extraordinary torsion field amplification just a few miles away from where she was crippled a week ago as we record this. And remember, the torsion field interactions are with rotating machinery. What happened on the Triumph? From our data at the moment, we only know there was a fire in the engine room. What is the engine room filled with? All kinds of rotating machinery. You have the engines rotating. You have the drive shaft rotating. You have the electrical generators making electricity, providing electricity for the lights and the pumps and the bathrooms and the food service and the heating elements and the air conditioning, and everything on ship is driven by rotating systems that are electrically based that were exposed, according to my measurements on that same ship, to extraordinary torsion field interactions that literally drove the Accutron off scale. And she is the only ship in the world in this particular time period, at the end of the Mayan calendar, according to the current interpretation, the 13th Baktum, on December 21, that was exposed to that field in that place in the Gulf of Mexico.
Where was she when this happened?
Well, it's not so much where she was, it's where she had been.
Okay.
Because it turns out that after our cruise, which was from December 17th, we left Galveston, we arrived back on the 22nd, the day after the solstice, we had been docked in Progreso for that entire day. We arrived in Progreso at dawn. Progreso is 2 hours away by bus from Chichen Itza. The most extraordinary readings I recorded in the entire expedition was when we docked at dawn at Progreso. All hell broke loose in the Accutron as we docked at dawn that morning. It turns out, and I will document this in the paper I will publish hopefully over the weekend on Enterprise, that that dock, that 4-mile-long concrete dock that the Mexicans had built as a terminal to bring all kinds of goods and services into the Yucatan, as that part of the Mexican state, that dock is acting as a huge torsion amplifier sticking out into the ocean. And I can see in my Accutron measurements the actual effects of waves striking the dock and causing resonant frequencies very melodically every 8 seconds, like clockwork. Tick, 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 both coming into and then leaving Progreso. The farther away we got from that dock, the lower the amplified background field became.
Okay.
Until it went back to the background.
Hmm.
The ship, after we had docked that morning, took three more cruises to and from the U.S. to the Yucatan, right? On each of those successive cruises leading up to the big breakdown a week ago, the passengers reported all kinds of electrical problems on the ship. In fact, the ship canceled going to Cozumel because she couldn't make enough headway because of her electrical generator problems to keep up enough speed to make the tour and go from Progreso to Cozumel and back to the United States. So they only went to Progreso and then back to the States. This same ship where I recorded these stunning readings only days before. It is my opinion that of all the ships on the planet, that particular ship, the Carnival Triumph, was exposed to a torsion field of such magnitude around those key dates, the solstice, the alignment, that its electrical system was such affected, it was affected in such a way that it eventually led a week ago to a fire in that same part of the ocean under the same conditions. It was like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
And what we need to do is pay very close attention to the reports of what happened to cause that fire, because if things happen the way they should, they won't know enough to not tell us all the events. If they suspect what I suspect, they will clam up and tell us nothing, and it will be just another big mystery that they don't want us to know about.
This particular concrete dock that you're talking about, this was working also then as an amplifier to...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And remember, going back to Kozarev's experiments, in order for a detector to work, it has to be moving. It has to vibrate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, every time the waves, and remember, the waves have a certain frequency because of gravity and tides and the ocean and the rhythmic... Think of water moving back and forth in a bathtub. The Gulf of Mexico is like a bathtub. And so you have wave-driven action by the winds that have a resonant frequency, right?
Sure.
So they're going to wash up on this dock at the base of it periodically. It turns out it's every 8 seconds. That, in turn, is going to cause that entire 4-mile-long concrete structure. Imagine how much concrete has to be in that structure. I haven't calculated how many millions of tons yet, but it's got to be enormous. It's like a huge tuning fork stuck out in the ocean. You can see it from space. You can go to Google Earth, center your Google Earth over the Yucatan, the northwestern shore, the edge of the Yucatan, and just zoom in, and you'll see this thing sticking out into the Gulf 4 miles. It's a 4-mile drive by car or bus to get to the ship or get to land, depending upon how you dock. This ship, the Triumph, is the only ship that I now know that arrives at dawn, and it was exposed to these unique, amazing torsion field conditions that I was in the right place at the right time to measure, Henrik, to subsequently suffer this catastrophic failure, I think because of the cumulative effects of the torsion field interfering with the electrical generating system and causing a shutdown in the engine room, including a fire as part of its failure mode.
I'm looking at the long structure at this moment.
Oh, you got it.
Yeah, I got it. It kind of reminds me of the tether incident also a little bit.
Doesn't it? Yeah. Doesn't it?
Interesting.
Anyway, you hit that with a wave, it's going to resonate. It's going to ping.
Mm.
And I picked up the pings coming to and leaving on the Accutron.
Hmm.
It's amazing. I mean, science is so cool, particularly when you turn it to trying to unearth thousands of year old mysteries that no one wants you to unearth.
Let me ask you this as well. There's obviously many different applications of this science or technology, whatever you want to call it. And maybe not at the lower end, because it still seems to have a tremendous benefit to it, but you can actually supercharge seeds. There are these old fertility festivals connected with this, and people like John Burke has detailed this of how you can actually place seeds on the pyramids or close thereof and to actually give them properties and benefits that are beneficial, right?
Again, this is totally real science. We were in Tikal. Our Mayan guide that NBC had hired to kind of take us around and, play mommy, daddy, tourist minder for the cameras. His name was Francisco Forian. He's the Mayan guy who explained when he saw what I was doing on the screen, oh my God, you're measuring things we've only heard about. He told us a very interesting story as we're standing there in the middle of the Tikal complex, because you got these huge pyramids rising like twins, flanking, straddling both sides of the main ceremonial plaza. And on one side, you've got a market where they would sell things to each other. And on the other side, you've got the royal and elite apartment complexes where all the, what I now call the 1%, we all know what that reference is to now, the guys that have it all in society, the 1%, where they would live and hang out. It was right next to the plaza with these huge pyramids. Well, Francesco, proceeded to tell us this story that in the archaeologists that over the years he had helped to excavate and measure and to try to reconstruct the culture of Tikal, what they found was that the elites all hung out around the pyramids in the plaza, and the peasants, the 99%, who basically made society possible, the farmers, the ones that grew the food and all that, they lived 10, 20, 30 miles away, and annually they would bring their seeds, and for a week-long festival, they would expose them in the plaza to the field of the pyramids flanking it. In other words, they would energize the seeds in that torsion field amplification, then take them back to their little homes and hovels and huts, and you know, put them in the ground, and they would produce a crop. The crop was much bigger than from seeds that were not exposed. But here's the really amazing part. He then got into the reconstruction from his friends, archaeologists and anthropologists, of the culture and lifespans of these two groups. Remember, the 1% that hung out around the pyramids, who lived there, and the 99% who lived 10, 20, 30 miles away and did the farming and maintained the culture, the food supply of the entire culture. That difference in where these peasants or these ancient Mayans lived resulted in the peasants dying around the age of 40, the ones who lived far away from the center of Tikal, and the elites who lived right next to the pyramids, they lived to be over 100.
This is kind of, it kind of plays into this idea of the fountain of youth, you know, Prester John
this
and all those
stories. This is the whole Ponce de Leon mythology, yeah. Yes, it's all been corrupt. In other words, if the torsion field is amplified, it basically keeps dissonance from affecting bodily functions, biological functions, and creates a much longer lifespan, or allows, I should say, a much longer lifespan than for the equivalent people eating, and this is important, eating exactly the same thing.
Sure.
The two groups ate the same things. The only difference was one lived near the pyramids where the field was strongest, the others lived 10, 20, 30 miles away where the field was weakest. They died quickest. The elites who lived around the pyramids lived the longest. And I'm able to measure quantitatively, scientifically, with 21st century digital instrumentation, I'm able to measure this field and these changes, and that's what blew this old Mayan's mind.
I have to ask you about the state then of the planet of Earth. You said before, without this grid, pretty much, of these structures, things would turn really, really bad. We have to talk just briefly about what you think caused this to begin with, because someone who built this obviously have to have a knowledge not only of how this works and everything, but how to, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of knowledge to be able to restore the properties of the planet, if you will. Do you believe that they were damaged in some way as a catastrophe kind of theory, binding
well,
into
this?
Well,
yeah, I mean, this is a very, very long discussion, obviously more shows. Just to give you the cliff notes, I think we have documented, together with Tom Van Flandern, that millions of years ago in the solar system there was a war, a huge, humongous, interplanetary war that wound up destroying an entire planet, so-called Planet 5, which used to live where the asteroid belt is now. And I have measured on Mars, which was an escaped satellite of this former planet, the tidal effects of that ancient war. And we wrote those all up on Enterprise. It's there. Just look for what's called the Mars Tidal Paper. You can Google it. You can put Enterprise. You can put my name in the slug line, and you'll eventually come to the Mars Tidal Paper, which is in several parts the ancient history of the solar system, which wound up basically destroying the harmonic physics of the solar system that existed before.
And that was naturally just in place, if you will.
That was in place. Well, that's another long discussion. Looking more and more now like the solar system is not natural, but it actually was carefully put together
right.
to encourage
right.
us guys being here. That's another long show, Henry.
I know.
We have lots of shows we can do. This is, remember, I've been at this 30 years. Our research has been scientifically trying to reconstruct what happened and why are we all in this place going through this bizarre situation?
Well, I know. See, that's why I appreciate it, because you have so much to add from, and that's why I want to tap into that as much as possible. But go ahead, Richard.
It used to be harmonic. There was a war. It then became incredibly disharmonic. Remember what we measured in the physics. The physics likes harmony. The physics hates disharmony. What does the physics do when it encounters disharmony? It tries to create harmony out of disharmony. How does it do that? Well, it turns out it reorients the spins and pointing directions of the various planets to try to synchronize them into a more harmonious model. The problem is, when you reorient a planet in space, you wind up killing mostly everybody on that planet. Because if a planet like Earth has oceans, the oceans will slosh. Think of it as an enormous bathtub effect. If they slosh as the pole reorients, as the pole physically changes orientation in space, the oceans will slosh across the continents. That sloshing will destroy everything in its path. It will grind up everything. It will bury it in miles of mud and sediments. It will kill everybody, the biosphere, you know, plants, animals, everything.
Sure.
Until a new orientation is established, things settle down, and then you have a period of quiescence until it gets out of harmony, and then it will have to shift again to try to reintroduce harmony. Because remember, it's all about, in the physics, rotation, rotation, rotation. So what it appears has happened is that from some extraordinary source of information, I presume our great-great-great ancestors, these what are called legacy cultures, like the Maya, like the Egyptians, like the Hindu, like the Tibetans, like all of your ancient indigenous cultures that built these incredible sacred complexes of architecture, what they all have been doing, unbeknownst to each of these cultures, is establishing their piece of a global network that would resonantly allow for the maintenance of the harmony of the planet, would not allow for disharmony, would keep the planet rotating in the right direction at the right rate so life on its surface could proceed, while they serve to amplify the more beneficial aspects of the background field and allow longer lifespans, more harmonious existence, the creation of harmonious societies, which all fall into disarray when something radically changes that is bigger than that natural network can handle, and the planet ultimately winds up flipping and the cultures wind up dying. Mm. And then having to be reborn in a new cycle of emergence of knowledge and wisdom and deep meditation and harmony. And that's what I think we're ultimately looking at. The scientific foundation of that extraordinary ancient saga, which was interfered by a war that never should have happened, and we have been living with the results in trying to handle it in various ways ever since, going back millions and millions of years. And I know, to anybody who doesn't understand that there is a whole hidden history to the human race, this is going to sound like the wildest made-up science fiction. No, it's not, because we are able to measure the physical effects with this instrumentation and produce results that are totally at variance with anything in mainstream science, but not with this model.
Very interesting. And do you think, Richard, that we are now then in a time then, if you will, when this knowledge is being restored, I guess we could call it? What do you think?
Well, there is an aspect of this physics. As the physics is changing, and I'm able to document, remember, I've got measurements now going back to 2004, to that first Venus transit.
Mm, yep.
I'm able to demonstrate the physics itself has changed in amplitude, in frequency. The readings we're getting now are not the same readings we got even just 8 years ago. Again, these are documented. This is archived science. You can't unring this bell. If this progression of changes continues, then the changes in our environment that are the result of this change of physics also will continue. And one of the things that we have postulated, which is why I wanted to do the consciousness measurements of Chichen Itza, is that these changes in the torsion field are changing consciousness all over the planet, even as we speak. And there are various ways of monitoring and checking to see if those consciousness changes are in fact occurring. And there are some quantitative measurements. One is called the Flynn curve. And there are all kinds of qualitative measurements. I mean, just look at television. Just look at CNN. Just look at how people are behaving. Look at politics. Look at what's going on nation to nation, people to people, institution to institution. If we're not in the middle of the biggest set of changes in modern history, then I will eat my nice straw hat that I bought to keep the sun off me at Chichen Itza.
Yeah.
And those changes, if we're right, will accelerate and will continue, I believe, coming to a crescendo, again, based now on the model and the measurements, not in 2012, but in 2016.
All right.
The real 2012 is still ahead, and extraordinary things are going to happen in all kinds of directions, up to and including more events, physical machinery events, where technology is interfered with by this physics because the designers of the technology don't understand there's a physics they have to allow for. And so there's increasing interference between the system that is and the system they're taught that is. And, of course, in nature, ultimately, you can't fool Mother Nature. So Mother Nature is going to assert her dominion, and the Carnival Triumph tragedy that we've seen, luckily nobody is lost their life or even has become ill, as far as I know, but their experience of 5 days of hell on the sea without bathrooms and electricity and modern conveniences appears to be a direct effect now of the interference of this physics with their systems that were never designed to allow for those effects.
Now, as you said, Richard, you've measured during the first Venus transit in 2008. You've been at Tikal, Coral Castle, now at Chichen Itza and everything else worse. Where do you need to go next? Where do you want to go next to be able to verify some more?
The world.
Everywhere around, huh?
I have to go everywhere. And we have to build more gadgets. I have to make them smaller. I'm actually going to try to make them the size of a tricorder. Because the thing that really opened me up at Chichen Itza, obviously, was the laptop. Nobody was being arrested for having a cell phone.
Yeah.
Nobody was being arrested for having an iPad. So what I'm going to do is to miniaturize, and I've got a company actually which has volunteered now to help me do this, to take and shrink everything down so it's the size of Spock's tricorder.
Everybody right.
knows tricorders from Star Trek.
Sure.
And so then we'll make multiple copies of these, and I will give them to people all over the world to do measurements on sacred sites where I can't reach because there's only a limited amount of time. And they will go in and they will surreptitiously, with no one knowing that they don't have an iPhone or a BlackBerry or a Droid, they will do measurements and they will funnel them back through the Internet to the Enterprise mission. And we will assemble a database of measurements all over the planet leading us to 2016, when some remarkably interesting things, according to this model now, appear to be in the cards to happen.
So do you think that the things talked about and expected for 2012 instead then are basically shifted forward to 2016? I know there's a lot of things said about it, so of course it's impossible to...
Yeah, I was going to say, which things are we talking about?
Exactly. But okay, let's assume all the positive changes. We're talking about an experience that has to do with a spiritual connection, intelligence, consciousness on the rise, etc. This didn't happen overnight, obviously, in 2012. So
No. That's why you have people like Callahan, bless his soul, trying to explain why, quote, nothing happened. You know, well, it's because it's the wrong date. I can prove unequivocally the real date, and the Mayans were not idiots. I mean, it never made sense to me. Why would the Mayans be off by 4 years? Well, do you understand that there is an interesting uncertainty in the Gregorian calendar as to when we actually measure AD and BC?
It's all over the place. It's lost. There's years,
but,
you know. Yeah.
But there is one, I mean, most of the dates that I've seen say we should adjust it by about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that goes back to when I was doing planetarium presentations in Springfield and at the Hayden Planetarium in New York, and we would always talk about the Christmas star. and the celestial object that may have appeared in the sky to the Magi, leading them to Bethlehem, etc., etc., a celestial event. But the problem is that the only really interesting celestial event that may have served as that tracer was 4 years away from the actual supposed date of the birth of Christ. Well, if those two observations are the same observation, in other words, the calendar is 4 years off, then this is not 2013. It's 2012, 10, 11. It's only 2009. 2012 was still ahead.
You're talking about that idea that Jesus was born on September 11th, 3 BC, right?
Something like that. I mean, there's a variety of dates. I mean, I've heard that March is the date, you know, because of lambs and lambing and all that.
Okay.
The point is that the Gregorian calendar is, in terms of Anno Domini, you know, AD and BC, is not accurate. And if we calibrate it using the astronomical anchoring I have done of the Mayan calendar, then the conversion rate is 4 years out of sync. Only 4 years out of 5,120. That's not bad, right?
No.
But all the officialdom has been 4 years out of date, which means that they all need to get their act together and keep doing whatever they've been doing to keep the world from tipping over, which is a whole other story about measurements we made during the cruise. And I don't think we have time to really get into it.
Wow. All right. Well, the drama continues. Ah, interesting. I'm looking forward to some of the papers, of course, that's going to be up here. We're going to link to those if they are indeed up as we link up this program, Richard. Wow, this is very interesting. And thank you for sharing all of this with us as well, of course. But is there anything now you want to add here at the end? And it could be anything you want, websites, or if there's any other tidbits about the whole story here that we need to wrap up on. What do you think?
Well, the one thing I would tell everybody is go prowl around enterprisemission.com, because everything in Enterprise is free. We don't charge for anything on Enterprise Mission. And as I said, these papers, particularly the paper kind of synopsizing the connection between my measurements on the cruise and what happened to the Triumph after our cruise, which I think is so important for people to kind of see that there is a connection here, and it's a cautionary tale about how we have to synchronize modern technology with these changes in the physics that's not going to allow us to get away with anything. If you don't conform to the physics, you're not going to be, shall we say, oriented in a more survival, positive-oriented mode, so you've got to get in sync with what the planet is really doing. And I think that's a major piece of information that we garnered from the crew, something that I would never have imagined when we modeled our expedition back before 2012.
All right, very good. We will wrap up on that note. Of course, enterprisemission.com, as Richard said, that's the website. Check out the Facebook groups as well for that. And thank you for your time today, Richard. So we'll say just continue with those readings and work on the updating of the Accutron instruments in the meantime.
It's my pleasure, Henrik, and please give Lana my regards.
All right, there you have it, our program for today. We have much more coming up later, of course. Thank you for listening today. We appreciate your interest and for staying with us as a member. Next on the program, we have Dan Johnson with us to talk about the NDAA and the situation in the United States of America. After this, Greg Braden, Josh Reeves, and Suzanne Posel. We'll be back soon, so take care, and we'll talk to you then.